coming to you from the desert southwest, deep beneath the sands near a place called Roswell. We are about to chew into a black box of disinformation, conspiracy, and alternative theories on a variety of subjects. Welcome. You have now tuned into the Rat Files. For the next hour, your lovely host, the Mouse, and her co-host, Lance, will take you deep down the rat hole, beyond the cover stories, the mainstream media hype, and the superficial but generally accepted consensus that most of the surface world believes is absolute truth. These are the Rat Files.
Welcome to another Rat Files podcast. I am your host, the Mouse, and joining us is my co-host, Lance.
Hello.
This week, while I've been busy at my more traditional work, Lance has come across an old friend who gave him not only the story for this week's podcast, but truly one of the most amazing reports of an abduction event that I think we've ever heard. In fact, there are only a few others that are as comparable, which have ever been reported publicly. This said, I'm going to turn it over to Lance tonight for our podcast, An Abduction Story, which, to be more fair about it, is actually a very delayed abduction report. Lance, can you take us down this frightening rat hole tonight?
Hello, Mouse, and everybody out there. And I want to preface this whole show with we've heard a lot. We've seen a lot of these third, fourth, fifth party. This happened in a brother of a friend of a cousin twice removed, you know, YouTube and the automated voice reading of a text script. And I've seen them. I've had a lot of doubts personally about them. I've heard a lot of the stories, and while there are a couple of rational ones out there that actually do make you stop and think, for example, like, the Travis Walton story, the Whitley Strieber story.
I met Travis.
Oh, Travis. Yes. And so again, that with some of these events, there are legitimate stories out there, but truthfully, I had never personally encountered anybody that had such a story that just sat down with me one-on-one. And the story tonight, and I've really got to get on it because it's quite a long one, started very strangely. As I mentioned, when I'm going to go into this, because I had tons of notes. I had a little pocket notebook in my pocket, and it just happened.
You always have one.
I normally keep something to write on because you never know when you're going to get the what I call the break of your life. And, you know, it's really nice to be able to take a note real quick and say, oh, wow, I caught this and here's the deal. And I filled up a notebook of what happened. And I got to say that it just come out of me. It fell out of the sky right into my lap, almost literally from a source, from an avenue that I would never in a million years have thought of. And it really, afterward, I've thought on it. I started not to even do a story on it because I didn't even... It's one of those breathtaking things like watching a car wreck.
Yeah, this was kind of an unscheduled podcast. We hadn't really planned on this one.
I didn't, actually.
It just kind of fell in our lap.
Yeah, I was working on a story about the Antarctic, and actually this fell in my lap, and I shelved that one to do this one real fast while it was fresh in my mind, and I remember the emotions and the detail and what I saw.
Well, kind of to be lighthearted, it would have been nice if you would have had a camera and got a couple of pictures.
It would have been really nice if I'd have had a video camera, or if I'd have thought about the fact that my cell phone could actually take video.
I could see you sitting there with him going, hey, drop your pants. I want to get a picture of your butt.
Stop. But anyhow, that I don't want to give away the story in trying to preface it other than to say I never saw this coming. It's not a friend of a friend of a friend. This is a direct second party reporting from the...
And you've known him for a long time.
A long time. I mean, decades. So again, let's go into it, and you'll kind of get the gist of where this goes. So I have to say this week has been, needless to say, very interesting for me. And while this type of topic would normally fall to Mouse, because she's the alien and the UFOs and all that, and again, I normally do the conspiracy, so it just so happened to me to have been an old friend of mine from years and years and years ago that it came from. Due to an interesting set of circumstances that many would call coincidence, and I don't really abide by the whole philosophy of coincidence, but I ended up running into this old friend while both he and I had some time to catch up on the past years since we had last talked. I'd worked with him. I knew him personally. Of course, we talked about school and different things we'd done in our schools and educational life, and then work and where we'd been since the last time we'd encountered each other. And just kind of a catching up of, you know, it's been years, hey, how's it going? Our overall careers. So the conversation had turned to families and several moves, where we'd been to last, our last journey or itinerary of all the places we'd been to lately. And we had both done, you know, through the intervening years since the last time we'd seen each other. And the topic that came up basically was, what are you up to now? And again, this is all lighthearted conversation. Didn't see anything coming out of it. Well, he was in the local area here in New Mexico on a contract. And anybody that lives in Roswell is very familiar with it. There's a lot of people come through the area that aren't tourists that actually are here for oil contracts, government contracts. There's a lot of contract work that floats through the area.
Construction.
And it was
pipelines.
Actually just coincidental how I met him. So we talked a little on his contract details, and he wasn't really impressed that day. And that was this week. So when the topic turned to being my turn, you know, I told him, hey, I kind of retired. I took an early retirement out of my last job, kind of. I still do a little bit of contracting on the side. Most of mine's online. We were joking about telecommuting around to Japan in our underwear with Cheetos at 3 a.m. because that's when we wanted to work. He thought that was a neat idea. We spent a lot of my time, discussing or talking about, doing this right here, you know, working on the podcast as I do. A majority of my semi almost completely retired time is tied up with it. So, and doing research for it and putting it together and having a great time. It's almost like being a paid 12-year-old for getting to play on your hobbies again and generally relaxing. And I told him about the podcast, gave him a business card, say, hey, check it out sometime. And he looked at the card kind of funny. We started discussing it deeper and what the subjects would cover. And, hey, I never thought all this was out there. And he's looking, his demeanor just changed. It just, I mean, seriously, his face almost got ashen. He quit talking. He wasn't smiling anymore. And I asked him if he was okay. Is there anything wrong? You don't look okay. And are you getting sick? He looked right at me and simply said, there's a lot of truth at the heart of this topic. Don't take it so lightly. Now, for most people to say that, the skeptic in me turns on automatically. You know, combined it with the likelihood of someone attempting to lie to you. You know, you may not know them well enough. And, of course, there's always that Andy Warhol moment of everyone, you know, wants their 15 minutes of fame. And, hey, oh, my, there's a hot mic. Let's jump up in front of it or the TV camera. And
which, by the way, is why we don't do a lot of interviews or anything.
We don't. And, again, it's not that I don't interview, but I don't put the interviewees on our podcast for I try to filter and meter it. I'll take a report. I'll sit down with an interview and write it down, and then I'll go research it. That is my intermediary break to get a chance to do that.
I have had several ask me why we don't do interviews. The reason why is because we don't want a bunch of people coming to us and go, ooh, I want to be on there. I want to tell you a story.
Yeah, I want to tell
I don't want a story.
I want to tell my story on the podcast, and we tell a story. We try to paint a picture here,
but we want facts.
But
to
I
back
want
it up.
I want facts. I want the data. I want the documents. I want the videos. And I'll often say, well, we got it from this source, or it's known history. Look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica or Wikipedia.
This is one of the few where we are not giving the name.
This I'm not. And again, the blatant reason is because this is a real man. I've known him for years, and I know the level of professional he is. It would literally destroy his professional life. He's not ready to retire, and I can't do that, and he asked me not to, which I cover that here in a minute. But anyhow, that to avoid the hot mic problem of anybody saying, hey, I've got a story, put me on your podcast, and I'll tell you a story, and then them get on there and either change it to something that has no topic, or they get off topic, and I don't have we don't have a huge crew. It's me and Mouse, so I don't have time to vet somebody and find out are they going to flake out on me. And if you've ever listened to Art Bell, you've heard some of his call-ins that They flaked out on him when he was doing live call-ins without any filtering of his call-ins.
And I just have to give kudos to Art Bell, because some of the stories he heard, and he still talked to them as if he believed every word. And there was no way.
I hope he's out there listening to our podcast.
He was some of those people.
Right. He's a great professional. I hope he listens to the podcast or does at some point. My hat's off to him because of all the live calls he did, and he was always able to fend them off, hit the drop button, and go on down to the next call. I don't have a switchboard. We don't have that kind of capital to be able to do this. And if I had a larger staff, we don't have
somebody to help filter for us.
It would be one thing if I was, somebody like Linda Moulton Howe or Whitley Strieber or Travis or whatever. Those guys come on, sure. I know exactly where they're going. I know that they're going to be professional about it, but it's hard to just grab guy off the street. So, and again, I'm getting off topic, but we don't do interviews for that. And I'm always terrified of that Andy Warhol moment. Somebody wants a hot mic, and then they start talking about something that's so far unscripted, off topic, or terrible to put on the air, and it just destroys your interview. Well, this guy isn't like that. He's a super professional. I mean, if you pictured him as an FBI agent or as a lawyer in a courtroom, this guy is very composed and very professional. And very educated. So, and he's never been like that. Literally, he's almost unfun to be around for the most part because he has no sense of humor. He's always so deadpan, and everything he says is like reading an educational textbook. He is what I call unimaginative. But exceedingly dependable. So
he and I don't get along well.
Yeah, I joke around with, and again, I've got basically the same education and experience he does. I'm a joker. I've got a great sense of humor. He is so deadpan, it's just unrealistic. So,
and I can laugh at the air, so.
And she's got an amazing sense of humor. But I really don't know how else to describe him. And I'd never known him to be a rowdy, a tale-teller, a fictionalist, or even a sharer of TV fiction at work. He had always been this super level-headed man who had only dealt with in facts. He dealt in facts. His life and his profession depended on him. So seldom he joked about anything or does joke about anything when I knew him and worked with him day to day. And when he said, "This is fact," then I took it as law that it was indeed fact. So there are very few people I've ever met that are this stern or sincere, let alone instantly believable upon hearing them for 10 minutes. You know you can trust what he's saying. Having run into him again, he seemed to be no different than the last time I'd seen him. So, again, it's rare that this kind of person you knew when you and they were 40 or 45 would be much different as you approach the age of 60. Most of your character changes in life are fixed and relatively stable by the time you hit 40. You're you by then. And he was just about identical from what I'd perceived of him years ago when I worked with him. Now, and I'm a little bit older than him. So when he asked to take the topic seriously, I smiled pleasantly and said, "But we do. In fact, we want to tell the truth as to the best we can research it for our shows. We don't make fun of subjects. We don't make light of topics. We always try to back up the facts with independent sources when possible." Now, of course, everyone knows that listens to our podcast religiously. We will state an opinion, but I always try to preface it with "my opinion is." So that way you can diversify from me saying this come out of this in 1207.
And we always close with, we want our listeners to decide
for
themselves.
Yeah, we want feedback. So, but it was then that he almost repeated what he said when I'm trying to tell him we take this seriously. He said, "The topic has a lot of truth in it. Don't ever take it lightly when you address it." And I mean, I've got quotation marks on that in my notes. He seemed not as warning about how he said it as almost melancholy. I told him that I didn't, but resources were very slim when it came to rock solid facts. I didn't have really any proof for abductions or any proof of some of the things we discussed. No one really, this is almost like in this what I call sincere Bigfoot research. They don't have proof either, but there are some real dedicated people trying their best to prove something that's almost impossible to prove. So I pointed out that cover up from official sources are almost impossible or almost absolute. Everyone is guessing. Few realize what any of this means, and the confusion feeds the cover up. whatever they're trying to cover up really implies. You know, you don't know what they're trying to cover up, but you know that the government and the powers that be really are good at it. So sure, a lot of people claim seeing grays, but it's a foggy or a freeze frame image they remember. A lot of people that claim to have been abducted claim they've seen a face for 10 seconds. They remember pain or they remember this. They have small details of what I call snapshot images they remember. One of the things that makes Travis Walton's story so amazing is he has not snapshots, but full video in his memory of what happened to him. Few have details or memories like this that happen, and even then there's no evidence usually associated in context with what they claim. With that, I said, we do the best we can with what we've got. So he looks me right in the face and calmly said, do you believe me enough to want to hear what happened to me? Well, I was stunned. I didn't know what to say. It's like a gut punch. Not from this guy. You know, my brain's instantly screaming, surely not him. You know, it's like the Pope or the President saying blatantly out and making a declaration, hey, I met an alien yesterday. It's just, what do you say to that? Actually, even more moving to me, I know this guy. You know, I mean, it's he's not a family member, but when you're old and you've known somebody for decades, you know, they look
as well, babe.
Yeah, they look at you, and you know, he gave me this look, and he told me he was grave serious, you know. So I replied, I'd be very honored to hear whatever you've got to say. And he then said, you have to promise me one thing, and that is you will never state my name. It will jeopardize my career, and I can't speak to what his career is, but it would. I know that. My personal life, I don't know what exactly other than what we discussed was going on in his. My credibility and God knows what other problems it would cause me if this ever came out that I told you this. So, again, this has caused me enough headache and concern, and this is him saying this. This is him that it's caused me, as he's speaking, enough headache and concern. I don't need it bursting into my day-to-day life and destroying my life, too. Promise me, and I'll give you a story you will not fully understand for what it is. It took me a long time to let it sink in, you know. And again, I'm shocked. How do you deal with this from a friend that you never imagined? So, you know, it's kind of one of those trauma-type things of your wife or your daughter or your son or whatever come to you and told you of a bad trauma they experienced while living in your house, and you'd be like, I never knew that happened.
And so, this guy just isn't one that you envision would ever say anything like this.
So, sure, you know, like all the simpletons who use computerized voices, again, on the YouTube to spin these stories, I've heard them, I know you've heard them, friend of a friend stories, heard the conspiracies, you don't hear a computerized voice on this end. This is my real voice. And if you've heard any of our other podcasts, we don't do fireside horror stories and things of that nature. We address things that are public knowledge, and we try to find as much information as we can on it. So most of those I highly doubt, the what I call the computer voices you will play on YouTube. While there are a few I personally credit, as mentioned before, I don't personally know any of these men or people that have claimed abduction. I know this guy looking at me, you know, 3 foot away, saying this to me. I know him and would take his word for an absolute solemn truth any day of the week. What do you say to such a Pandora's box of absolute fact? So I promised him that his name would never arise from this, but the story would be told depending on what it was about. Again, I don't know what he's talking about, but he's alluding to something involving what we talk about.
Right.
So, you know, ghost, paranormal, UFOs. I don't know exactly. Yeah, I don't know where he's going with this, but I promised him I won't bring your name up. So he then began his story. He took my word, and he began his story with a time frame. It was 1995.
Right.
Now, to make the story easier for me to tell, because I'll end up stumbling all over it otherwise, is we're going to give him the name Mark, and I promise you his name is not Mark, but it'll help me telling the story. So, yeah, it's not his actual name. It's just a pseudonym for me to, when I was putting my notes together, to call his name Mark. And that was all I could think of. So, but it will help me explain it to you a lot better and keep the images straight in your head. Mark was in the military at the time of these events. He was stationed at a large, well-known U.S. military base. He was married at the time, lived in base housing with his wife. Now, I know all this to be fact, as I had many photos of his service time. I'd seen them when we had worked together. We had pulled, you know, because I'm former military too. I was in a little bit before he was, and we'd shared the photos and compared scrapbooks and all that. And so I'd seen the photos. I know what a real base picture looks like.
And
a base
all the, ooh, and, you mean you really look like that?
Yeah, and that was back when, y'all, a lot better shape than I am now. So while I'm older and had served before he did, we knew the life pretty well, and we talked about a lot of things.
Well, he looked a lot different, too.
Yeah, he did, too. He looked like a little kid. So, as he pointed out, he had most weekends off. Excuse me. As many military members have when they're stateside, you know, weekends, and most guys that have been in the military will tell you, weekends, you're secured for liberty, you know, from Friday at 5 or 6, whenever you get secured, till Monday morning. You get your little safety weekend safety briefing and all that. So it was a Saturday night. This is him telling it. It was a Saturday night, Sunday morning time frame on April 15th, 95. Now, they were it not for it being tax day, the 15th was tax day, actually, he wouldn't have even been able to set the date that well. He had tried, he said, tried terribly to forget what happened so badly. As he spoke, I got my notepad out, and I'm taking these notes, and I sat there silently as he's slowly forming these words. He's talking slow, very deliberate. He's kind of in a, what I call a thousand-yard stare, just staring into the distance and trying to speak slowly, like he's picking each word painfully. So, to me, it felt like he needed to say this, but it was clearly painful for him to say what he was saying. Like he was pulling a heavy load up a hill. He was really labored about it, but he continued. On most weekends, he said, he and his wife would go out, have drinks, get with friends, come home after midnight, and either watch a movie or sit and talk before going to bed. Because it was tax time, and specifically tax day on the 15th, he and his wife had waited up until that last minute. I think they filed on a Friday, as he said. But they had no money because he was short taxes, owed to $100-$150. He didn't have any money after they sent the check out. They were tapped.
Wouldn't have till the
next
they
week. Were tapped out, and they didn't. Anybody that remembers filing taxes the old paper way back in the day before all the online filing, you know, here he is running for the last minute, and he's got to send that check in with his return. Right, got to get that postmark on there before midnight on the 15th. So he decided they were going to have simply just have a dinner at home that weekend, that Saturday night, and go to bed early. By his remembrance, he said that night they had gone to bed by 10 p.m. And that's unheard of for them on a Saturday night normally, but between short on money and had to eat in, didn't get to go out, they were just kind of bummed out, so they went to bed early. The next morning, he said he slept so hard, he slowly came out of what almost felt like a drug-induced medicated state. If it weren't for the pain on his right hip, he said he would most likely would have slept for hours more. It was daylight on Sunday morning when he awoke to a scream that was, in fact, his own. He said, "The first thing I felt when I woke up was that someone had set me on fire." He said it felt like somebody hit him with a branding iron, is what he said.
Right.
As he came to, at first he thought it was just a dream. So since he woke up and thought he'd had a dream of being burned in a fire or something, and he woke to literally hearing himself scream, and then he noticed the pain was searing and it still was hurting him as he was waking up. He turned to his wife and apologized if he scared her, as he's trying to figure out what's wrong and why he feels like he's on fire. She didn't appear to be breathing. And then first thing he's doing is scanning the room, afraid the house is on fire, and she doesn't look like she's breathing. So he shook her, and she finally took a slow, shallow breath, but he couldn't get her to wake up. In a panic, still feeling like his hip is on fire, is his right hip, he said he shook her until she awoke. And with a terrible, terrible headache, he said, "She lit in on me for waking her like I had drove over the house cat. And she, you know, he told me, he said, "I truthfully didn't think she was going to wake up. I didn't think I was going to be able to wake her up. She was like she was drugged on morphine." He said that he told her that he felt like his hip was on fire. He was making a big deal about it. She said he was being silly and foolish. They had a king-size waterbed. So they're laying in a king-size waterbed. Of course, it's got a heater. But the heater, if anybody's ever had an old waterbed, and I think he said theirs was waveless, the heating element is between the waterbed mattress and the lower part of the frame. So it's not like you sleep on the heater. you're sleeping on the water, but the water underneath the water mattress itself is where the heater is.
Well, even if it wasn't a waveless, your heater is in the middle.
It's up under the mattress. It's under the mattress. It's not under you. Yeah. So he said to her in reply, she said to him in reply, "You're silly. There's no waterbed that's going to burn you." And he said, "You know, stop being like that. I'm burned. I've got a burn. Look." And she keeps pushing her to look. And she finally relented and said, "Fine, let me see your hip roll over." And on his hip was a 1/2-inch, perfectly symmetrical, equilateral triangle that looked like someone had used a hot blade or a knife and brandished a burn there. It was whelped, but it wasn't singed, it wasn't blackened, it wasn't charred like a third-degree burn. It was like a second-degree, almost like a water blister, but it was actually flesh whelped up. It was red. And it was, I don't know, he said maybe a second degree burn, but it didn't have charring, and there wasn't a water blister there, actually. He said that was the weird part. He got out of bed and looked, you know, all on and around and under the bed. He wanted to make sure, because the first thing she started screaming was, "We're going to get electrocuted." Her first thought was that the water heater mattress had shorted out and almost had electrocuted them. Well, he's checking everything out. There's nothing wrong with the water heater itself, the liner. It's not burned, pinched, damaged, and the heater element is not burned or damaged.
So he confirmed it was not the bed in any way.
He almost tore the whole waterbed apart, he said, because he was at the point of draining the mattress. He was about ready to go get the hose pipe and drain the mattress into the tub and let the water flow out so he could check and make sure there wasn't a short in the
right.
heater element. And there was only a waterbed mattress and a sheet beneath where he'd been laying. So it had gotten hot enough, whatever it was that had happened, to brand him on that right hip while not burning or damaging. As anybody, again, knows, it's just a vinyl mattress is all it is. It's a hollow cavity that you pour water into and put your conditioner in and damage the waterbed mattress. It didn't damage it in any way. So he got up. He walks over to the closet, which had, accordion doors. He said there were vented louver doors and accordion, and he took the knobs and he grabbed them, and when he opened the doors to get his robe, in a mind-boggling second, he said he saw a blinding flash of blue light from the closet. I didn't ask him to confirm that, he had opened the doors, but the way he made it sound, he said as he took them and opened them, so I'm assuming the doors were open, he saw the flash. It wasn't really happening, but he said it felt like a memory. It was like hitting rewind on a DVR and watching it happen. He stopped, he stuttered, he stumbled backward, he said, and he just plopped down on the corner of the waterbed. And then like a DVR and rewind, he saw a scene play out in his mind. He said his wife was talking to him, but as he sat on the corner of the bed watching this strange memory replay, his wife uselessly asked him over and over and over again if he was okay. As he seemed to be in a trance on the edge of the bed, not moving, not talking, just sitting there staring into the closet. He said he didn't know how long this went on, or didn't know this at the time. His wife went through it again for him later, and after he snapped back into where he was. She said he was like that, like a catatonic state for 10 or 15 seconds. Not long enough that she called 911, but she was about to. She wondered if he'd had a stroke or something had happened because of the way he stumbled backward, sat down, and just froze. He didn't respond. Because of how he just froze and stared straight ahead for those few seconds, he said all of what he next saw happened in his mind in those next 10 to 15 seconds. It was like memory rushing to catch back up to him. Mark told me that the images cleared up second by second, and though he's not sure when it began the night prior, he's confident that next things that I'm about to tell you happened that night before, when he did in fact see them happen. In Mark's own words, this is what he saw in the flashback as he sat on the bed. Quote, "I don't know how I got there, but I'm laying on a silver table. It looks like maybe a serving tray or a mortuary table. There's no frills, no mattress, no sheets, just a steel." He said it looked like silver, stainless steel, or aluminum. "It has holes in it like it's for air or for air path or something. It's like it's punched through like a drain tray would be. The complete surface was vented with these little holes," he said, to what he looked at when he saw them. "It was like they were maybe 1/4 inch in diameter, maybe smaller. I'm laying on this table, he said. It is bright. There are lights overhead. Oh, my God, I think at that moment I've been hurt. I'm in an emergency room somewhere. Something's bad's happened. Where are the doctors? And why does it look like a mortuary table?
That's what I would think.
He looks to what would be his right. He said almost everything in the room is silver, like it's made of this brushed aluminum or stainless steel. In the center of the floor, there are two round-looking, he said, tubes. He said they were elevators, but they looked like they were circular, like a tube, and they were connected. So if you looked at it from above, it almost apparently, from what he described, it sounded like a figure eight. At first, and he, the way he described it, there were maybe 6 foot, each tube was 6 foot, 5-6 foot in diameter, the way he described it. At first, he thought they might just be doors or something going into maybe another room behind it, or a stairway or something like that. But as one rose and the door opened, you could see the light shift inside it as the door opened, and as an elevator might function.
Right.
Out steps, and he paused, telling me, and Mark just froze. And he looks at me like he doesn't even have the words for it. And then he continues. He says it looked like a tall gray alien. Like they've explained to you how grays look, only this one is much taller. Now, I don't understand this, or he said, I don't understand this. Was everybody wrong? Why is this thing so tall? Then the other elevator shaft opens and two grays come out of it as the doors close to the first elevator shaft. There are several in the room with him now, but it's like he is on morphine. He can't move except for just barely in slow motion turn his head as he's laying on this table. He just turns his head slightly, but he can't talk. He can't open his mouth. He feels very groggy and sleepy as he lays on the table watching all of this.
I would be petrified.
One of the short grays walked over, because there was more than one apparently to come out. I don't know. He said a couple, but I from the impression I got, he meant more than two. One of the short grays walked over and are handling him really roughly, like a, he said, handling me like a side of meat's what he said, moving his body, trying to, and he paused and he said, thinks they were repositioning him on the table for whatever reason. They have some tool in their hand, like a splayed pair of pliers or something, but I can't see what they're doing, but they look like bright chrome shiny pliers. He begins to struggle, but he feels so absolutely drugged. He grabs a small gray by the throat. And by the way, this is the first time I've ever heard anybody ever claim they've grabbed one of these things.
Yeah, that was amazing.
He grabbed it by the throat. He said it felt just like a frog. He compared the grabbing of it of a big fat bullfrog like when he was a kid. He said they're not firm. It wasn't firm. It was as he put it, it's like squishy silicone rubber.
Squishy
was the way, and I wrote that down in parentheses because I was like, squishy, what a word to use.
That's a mouse word, you know.
It is, but it was a word, and I didn't expect him to use that word either because that really isn't in his normal vocabulary. But he said it was like a soft, malleable, almost silicone rubber. It had no tone, no texture. This is the neck of this gray he's describing, this short three and a half. This is one of the short grays. There apparently were two to three of them in the room, one tall that he saw. The short gray's neck is what he's referring to. He choked down on this neck throat he had a hold of, but it didn't seem to affect the gray in any way at all. It looked at him as if he was annoying it. He first thought that must be the drugs. He thought maybe he didn't have any strength in his arm because he was drugged. Maybe he's barely got his hand on the neck. Mark said, so he tried to smack it. He tried to hit at the gray. As he did make contact and hit it, he said the once small mouth of the gray, like he said, you know how they look like little quarter or dime-sized holes on their face when they show them on TV?
Or just a little line.
He said what happened next terrified him. He said the mouth of what no longer appeared to be a quarter and passive without expression, just a bland expression. He said it smiled and it opened up into one of the most contorted, almost maniacally evil grimaces you've ever seen. He said the smile went almost from the edge of their eyes on the left side to the edge of the eyes on the right side. He said the face almost distorted. It smiled so wide. And he said, oh my God. He said they have teeth like a moray eel. They're needles.
Ew.
He said the look was absolutely pure evil. The look it gave me is like something you'd see in a terrible horror movie. They aren't benign. He said, in that moment, I knew if it could kill me, it would. And he said, really, and the way he put it to me, he said, I'm afraid that the best way I was going to get out of this was him killing me. I worried they would enjoy doing worse things to me than killing me. He's, and so Mark's voice is rising. And I mean, he, seriously, he's got a tear in his eye. You could see he was upset with the retelling. I was afraid, and part of me wanted him to stop, and the other part of me was really just hoping he wouldn't because I wanted to hear this. Now, he tried to scream, he said, and he started to make a noise. More came. Another tall one, and now a very, very tall, gaunt, Caucasian-appearing human with a white lab coat on. At first, he looked like any lean, really, really gaunt, lean person might. But Mark said, as he came closer, there was just something about this man that did not look right. It looked faked. It looked synthetic. It looked unearthly. It looked unhuman. He said, not inhuman, unhuman. And I said, I couldn't understand why he chose that phrasing. The man was angered and said very sternly to the tall and two short grays that were there originally, restrain him. And the man was very agitated. He said, do not damage him. He cannot harm you. You must hold him still. You must restrain him now. Do it. The grays held him down by his shoulders as the scientist-looking man connected something to Mark's arm. Nothing is said, but they seem to be testing him for something, Mark said. For whatever reason, he said he actually grabbed the small gray by the neck again, and he said, with all the force I could, I bent the whole neck and head in an absolutely unnatural way backward, as if it could, the head touched the back of his back.
Wow.
He said, short of it being an octopus's tentacle, nothing that I've ever known that had bones in it could contort like that. If it had a spine, it just couldn't do it. The head just popped back up like a rubber ball or a rubber ball on a rubber stem that had been bent around. He said in that moment it was like something or someone spoke to him in his mind and said, they're android-like in your terminology, and that they're much harder to injure or damage than you are capable of. Cease. Mark said he released the little gray's neck as the elevator door opened again. This time he said something stepped out of the elevator that he had never heard of or seen before. It walked like a man, but it was solid black. As it neared the procedure table, he realized it looked like it was a black lightning bolt. Mark said he had no other way to describe this thing. It smelled like it had been burned. Looked like it was a frazzled, walking lightning bolt, and it seemed rather unconcerned about the procedure going on. As he looked at it, the charred, blackened, walking ember, it was like someone was answering his questions in his mind. Quote, there are a few of them. They are here for security work, a voice told him.
Now, the gray that Mark had grabbed, was that the tall one, or was it one of the short ones?
From what he said, as he told it again, it was the short gray, or one of the short grays. I didn't directly ask him how tall either of the grays were, but as he spoke, he was moving his hands. He talks with his hands, so he's moving his hands around. He indicated the short one was maybe 3 to 4 feet, where he held his hand on
his
body.
The ones I've always said were cute.
Yeah, the one he said was just pure evil.
They don't sound too cute.
Yeah, it's not evil, according to him. And that the taller one was maybe 5 to 5.5 feet tall. He did, however, say that because the scientist-looking one somehow looked human, kind of in an inhuman, or as he put it, unhuman way, was so gaunt and frail-looking, he seemed to tower over all of them. From him laying on his back on a table, and that's kind of a hard way to ever get an assessment of how tall anything is, but
exactly.
He estimated 6.5 to 7 feet, so it seemed to him on the table at the time, anyhow. Anyway, his attention turned back to the scientist. He rotated his head to face the scientist, which was on his left side, which, from the way he described it, he was on a table. And there was you walk all the way around the table the way he said, but behind him to the left, To his left side was like a bank, a wall of computer monitors and screens. He said it looked, that wall looked like something you'd see in a space station or in a space shuttle or something. It was a wall of screens and gauges and dials and all sorts of buttons and flashing things. And the scientist walked apparently between that wall and him while everybody else was like on the other side of the table between the table and the elevator tubes. And that was the best I could get from the, and again, short of drawing a picture, I'm not that good of an artist, so I could never draw one, but
it was just a guesstimation from his description.
I could envision it from what he was saying. Yeah, he said the scientist seemed infuriated, and Mark remembered him saying, "These are simpletons. Intelligent? Why, they are barely sentient." And that was the way Mark mocked him or replicated what he said. The tall gray looked at the scientist and said, "Should we kill him and dispose of him now?" The scientist looked at the gray, paused for a second, and said, "No. Remove the device and return him. He is so primitive, barbaric, he serves us no further purpose. Remove the device and take him from our..." And then Mark said it was a word he had never heard, but he assumes it means records or database. He's unsure of what it meant. He called it my word, but feels that that is what they meant. Basically, remove him from our tests, our trials, our records, our database.
Right.
You can kind of plug in your own word there, but it was a word he didn't know the meaning of. And, of course, he wasn't quite in the shape to ask questions. So he said he felt it meant records or database.
Right.
"We will not retrieve him again," said the scientist. "So, look, even now he awakens. Our sedatives have no more effect on this barbaric animal. Get this done now. We do not want him becoming fully aware while here."
So was he really talking, or was it like mental telepathy?
And that was something
in his
now,
head,
Mark
or?
Points it out later in my notes, and I don't know if I put it in here or not. I'll have to look in my notes for the show, because in my notes I don't read my notes from what happened directly into the show. Mark told me, he said, at times it was like they were talking to him in his mind, and at other times he would see mouths move, but he said it was like a cheap Chinese-Japanese Kung Fu movie from the late 60s, early 70s. There was a dissynchronization between the movement of the mouth and the words spoken when they did. And often what he said was, it didn't look like the mouth moved in the right way to make the words he heard. And again, I've seen a few overscribed movies that were like French, and then they put them in English, and then they put them back in French, and then back to German. And if you do that
they
to a movie,
match.
Yeah, it just doesn't line up. So again, was he hearing another thing? Was he hearing somebody telepathically? I don't know. I mean, I'm taking notes, and it's he was right starting out. I'm trying to fight to understand what he's saying, and I couldn't get past, you know, what he's trying to tell me. I wasn't even sure if I was asking the right questions at that point.
Right.
Mark then noticed that the floor is flat, but the outer wall seems to sweep in a curve as if the room is curved on the outer wall. And again, I know he has a strong math and science background, so he's sitting here trying to estimate radii. How he could do that, I don't know, because, I mean, if I'm laying on my back on a gurney stretcher,
it's hard enough to determine how
high the ceiling
is. I
can't envision trying to estimate how big a radius sweep is on a roof. If you've ever tried to do radius estimations, just ballparking it, it's not easy when you get into big sweeps like in an auditorium or a stadium, because where you think that roof is 50 foot off the ground and it sweeps, you know, across a basketball stadium, in reality that radius may be 300 feet because you've got to assume a whole bunch for that radius sweep.
Much less trying to do it while you're
right.
Laying flat on your back.
Yeah, I mean, and again, laying flat on your back is not exactly the best place to do, like, you know, surveying. So,
right.
Mark then notices that the ceiling also does. It does also curve in a larger radius, or the roof or whatever it is, versus the outer wall. So the outer wall is curving around the plane of the floor, and then the roof is curving over top of the floor.
Right.
as a tangent to it. So as he looks in a drug-induced euphoria around the room, he feels as if it's a vessel of some sort. A voice seems to answer him in his head almost instantly. He said it's like being plugged into a radio, a two-way CB that as soon as he thought a question, if it was concise, he was getting answers back. And again, he said, if I wasn't so drugged, I would have thrown every question at him I could. But I was drugged to the point, of course, I didn't remember when I first come back. But the voice answered him in his replay in his mind. It is a vessel that is three levels vertical. You are on level two. In that moment, the tall gray placed what appears to be a stainless steel lollipop. He said it looked just like one of the old dum-dum suckers, he said, except it was all stainless steel and much longer. The thing held it, the alien, the gray, held it by his hand and touched the head of this round, it's just like a little 1-inch diameter sphere on the end of a stainless steel stick, he said.
Like one of the little xylophone playing.
He touched it, yeah, kind of. He touched it to Mark's right hip. He said he didn't know how else to describe the thing. And it started feeling like it was buzzing or vibrating at a very high speed, like an ultrasonic device. Then it started warming up. Then it got hot. Then it became excruciating. His last image was of them laying him in his bed right beside his wife while he slept, or while she slept, rather. He was almost out of it, too. They went back to a blue light that appeared to be a doorway in the closet. Then it closed and disappeared.
Oh, wow.
The light did.
I'd be scared to open that closet again.
At this point, I'm talking to Mark now, and he had a tear in his eye. He actually had a tear on his cheek as he finished the story, and we were both silent for a minute. I didn't know what to say. I mean, again,
right.
I'm just so breathtaking by this story. This isn't made up. He's in tears over
this
thing.
And not to forget, this is a guy who doesn't stretch the truth.
He's been in the military. He's not a wimp by any means. He's educated, and he's a very, very stand-up kind of, he's just, you know, I hate the old cliche saying, but he is salt of the earth. He's just so down-to-earth real that you just can't get past it.
He's never even been one that would tell gossip, though.
So I didn't want to say anything to him in fear of traumatizing the situation worse or ask him any more, although I had, the questions were starting to form in my mind, and I knew I was about to bombard him. And I didn't want to. He really looked shattered just telling the story. I knew his wife had divorced him around 2002, but I didn't know any details about that. I was afraid to ask if this event might have contributed or led to the divorce. Several minutes went by before he could talk again. I finally asked Mark, I'm sure you've dwelt on the details of this far more than any human ever should or could. And I hate to ask anything more of you on it, but in the years since, have you ever reasoned out anything about this event? Do you feel it was real? Did they ever come back that you remember? Do you have opinions of what happened beyond the facts of what you saw in those few seconds? Mark took a second and he looked at me as if he was really in deep thought. And I'm sure he had already thought of this enough, but I'm sure he was really digging for the right words because he was so measured in a lot of the stuff he had said. And he opened up by saying, you know, I've really tried to forget this. Then I tried to remember absolutely every second of it. I could never decide which one would be better for me in the end. I felt so helpless. He said, you have no idea how that level of helplessness feels. It was bondage. He said it was kidnapping. He said it was like a spiritual or a soul felt rape. And he just stopped for a second. I thought, wow, I mean, you know, really it is. I didn't know, he said, I didn't know which would be better, to seek more information or forget what I experienced. I know, he said, and the last thing I really, and that was something he was adamant about, he said, how do you seek help, ready to risk your life, your profession, all your education, your experiences, your background? How do you lay all that on the line trying to find somebody that might help you, but more than likely will opportunistically take advantage of you and sell your name to, and I've got another abductee here? He said, there's only a few in the world that really help anybody that has this issue. In the end, you've just got to suck it up and be strong and live with it. He said, I know there are some that have come forward to explain what they've been through, But he said, I can't deal with the heckling after what I've been through. He said, you wouldn't heckle a torture victim. You wouldn't heckle a rape victim. He said, but any and all skeptic in the woodwork that has no clue will jump out there and tear me apart the moment I say I've had this happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And I seriously, he almost made me want to cry for him. I felt so bad. It was just horrible. I couldn't imagine being in that kind of mental situation. So he said, I know that when I woke up at first, I only saw the room like I was in a daze. But as I seemed to come awake more and more, I could hear more. He's talking about when he in the start of his vision on the ship or in the location, wherever he was.
Wherever they took him to.
He says, I know that when I woke up at first, I only saw the room like I was in a daze. But as I seemed to come awake more and more, I could hear more like they were talking. But also there were voices in my head while I was there and awake that I could also hear, but I never saw them. Now, whether it was in my head or nearby, I don't know. From the sum of all I heard, and I started getting the feeling that he was changing the subject because he didn't really want to talk about the personal violation of soul and spirit and personal space he had dealt with. He said, from the sum of all I heard, both spoken and apparently telepathically, they are total atheists. He said, they don't believe in a creator. They have no species memory or history of a creator legend in their race.
Hmm.
They don't have a Bible. They don't have theology. They don't have, he said, it was kind of funny. He used the word, he said, they're like cockroaches. He said, they do. He said, they don't have a theology at all. They're just cockroaches. But he said also, that's a damn sociopathic way to have a race or existence of beings, because you can't imagine what they're capable of if they don't have any moral guidance as a result of it. And I thought about that. That was really deep. That told me he had thought a lot about this. They are like pirates, he said. Again, that was another thing he analyzed them and compared them to. They're like pirates. He said they seek many things in the galaxy. They travel far and wide. Maybe the whole universe. He said, all I know is I saw as they were moving. Apparently, it was like he could see through the telepathy, whether it was a link with their computer, their ship, whatever. Maybe the universe. He said he could see star fields and see them traveling at very rapid rates. He said they look for knowledge. He compared it to Star Trek in a way. He said not quite the zip and you're gone, but like you could see the star anytime, and anybody will tell you, if you can be in a ship moving fast enough to literally see stars moving like road signs on the side of the road as you're driving through them, that's pretty fast when it comes to traveling in space. Is it light speed? It's very possible it could be approaching light speed or even some kind of wormhole effect greater than light speed. But anyhow, they look for knowledge, oddities, rarities, and myths. The stories of a spirit or a soul in humans is what has drawn them here. He said it has them exceedingly intrigued. From what I get from it, and if we have one, they want to find it. Now, this is him saying this. He said his take on this is they're looking for proof of the human soul. They don't have one. He said, as they appear to have dissected so many of their own race, they've come to the conclusion they don't have a soul. And they are pretty convinced we do. They see all that we've done and built. They know the other races of beings. They interact with most of them, apparently, either love or hate. They can't understand how we have come so far to be so ignorant and primitive and violent and warlike, and yet be able of some of the great artistic, benevolent, and philanthropic methods and ideals that we are. They can't find sources of others like themselves that have given us everything we have. They're, again, this is assuming on the elimination of possibilities. They can't find all the contributors that could have given us what we have. So it's like they credit this missing component to a human soul that they can't weigh or measure. They have no scientific way to capture, and they want to know what makes us so different.
Right.
Because in their mind, why aren't we the same as a gorilla or a cow or a canary or a dolphin? Sure, those things can act intelligently, but also they don't have a soul. Apparently, they're wanting to find what makes us different than all the other animals, and they're stumped on this. They think they know who our true creator is. This is Mark speaking. He seems to think the aliens know who our true creator is, and the way he said that made me believe is one. They see him as one like them, another race equal to them in their great wisdom, perhaps. Not some fantasy, but the Greys don't feel he's capable of such an accomplishment of work at this level without far greater help or skill, because they don't think he has the ability himself. So in other words, he's claiming they think they know who our God is, and they don't think he's capable of making us. So again, this is the quandary. Everybody wants to know, why are they visiting us? I think Mark has actually found a very strong candidate or contender for the reason everybody's looking for.
Right.
And he's tore this apart in his head. He's a very smart man. I can't say enough about him, but I can't believe he's been tormented by this at the same time. He's got a really ingenious idea. He said they do these abductions a lot more than anyone thinks, and their resources are inconsequential. The technology they trade to us for various deals is old stuff. Like us trading a 286 PC for gold or oil, the technology is far outdated to them, and they are getting far more than anyone realizes by doing so. We are no threat to them that they cannot handle. I feel like we were so inconsequential to them, Mark said, they'd either ignore us or destroy us and our world if it weren't for them chasing this legend of the soul thing. Apparently they believe it is real, but don't scientifically know how to find it or measure it or how it integrates with the human form and possibly how it affects it or whatever. And so they're still here looking, and they've been here, you know, not to be cliche, but a very, very long time. The blue door is just that, a portal. Another place, another time, he didn't know. Mark said, I think I was on a ship, but not in some earthbound underground bunker. Everybody says places in the, like Dulce and Taos and stuff. He said, I think it was a ship. And yes, since all this happened, I have looked into the subject a lot. I've sought my own answers. I always feared they were good at their word and would come back to kill me, though I didn't think I'm of any importance to them and their plan for them to actually do so. I think they look at us about like we look at ants or cattle. We're unimportant, but they don't have any qualms about killing us either. They are major-scale pirates at best, and to look at them as any other thing or expect more out of them is just ignorance on our behalf. I know what evil I saw that night, and I'm here to tell you these beings, these creatures, are evil. And Mark concluded with, this is my whole sum of what I perceive, what I think of the event, what I heard, what I felt, and my overall opinion since years ago when this happened.
Wow.
He finished his story with telling me, in regards to what I said in the beginning, take this seriously, the whole topic. I'm sure there are skeptics out there. And he said, you want to know the really sick, the punchline to this? He said, the joke is on the skeptics if they think they haven't been abducted too. He said, every time somebody heckles this whole subject, my only reward, my only self-satisfaction is to know I can't imagine what you've had done to you that you can't even remember. I think that most of all humanity has, actually. They have been here such a long time and are looking too hard, wanting this answer far too much, to not have been through most of us now or by now trying to find it. I'm sure they've killed a lot of people too along the way, trying to extract it. To my knowledge, they have never come back for me again because they wrote me off as, quote, too primitive, as they said. Barely sentient, as they said. I think what bothered the scientists the most was that whatever they gave me as a drug or an effect stopped working on me, excuse me, and I started to wake up in there. I'm sure if they couldn't keep me sedated, though, I'm quite confident that they would have killed me if I'd threatened them any more than I did. Take this whole topic as dead serious. Yes, there are skeptics. Yes, there are those who laugh about it and cry wolf. But remember, they aren't the threat. They're the fools that don't even know to scream fire as their house burns down. Mark said, I still have the scar, you know. And at that point, he just stood right up and dropped his trouser about 4 inches off his right hip and showed me this perfect. I mean,
in the middle of a local restaurant, by the way.
It was quite interesting. But he dropped it and showed me this perfect triangular scar on his right hip, and it's still there. 22 years later, it looks like a brand. I mean, seriously, here in New Mexico, everybody knows what a brand for a cow is. Well, this looked like somebody had branded him with a perfect equilateral triangle, a half inch on each side. I believe he told me the absolute truth as he remembers it, and that triangle on his hip is no fantasy. I saw it. How do you burn something like that into somebody while they're sleeping in a waterbed? I mean, he went to bed sober. Early that Saturday night, woke up the next morning in a waterbed with a perfect triangle burned into his right hip as if he'd been branded, and his wife never woke up during the event.
Wow. I mean, truly, just wow. Have nothing else really to say about that because that's a frightening story. Do you believe it's true?
I mean, again, I've known Mark a long time, and I was about to say that anyhow, but I have known him a long time. I mean, 27, 30, yeah, looking at least 30 years. So if you saw the look in his eyes as he told me this, as the tears started to form, yes, I'd bet my own life on the fact that he remembers it better than I remember yesterday, and that it did happen to him. And again, the selling point of this not being a dream is that burned triangle on his hip, that he believes what he saw is what happened. And again, it wasn't like he was out drinking the night before and sat on a radiator or whatever. He and his wife stayed home and had dinner at home. She cooked, he didn't, so he wasn't in the kitchen. He said, I've tore that whole evening apart from the time I got off work.
I don't think he can cook.
Well, again, he said, I tore that whole day apart from 12 hours earlier to think about, have I been anywhere near anything hot that would have done that to me? And the answer is no. He said, I literally have stepped through that day 1,000 times in my mind, and nothing I've touched would have done that. So I bet my life on the fact that he remembers it better than I probably remember yesterday, and that it did happen to him. What happened is bad. That it most assuredly affected his life is terrible. That it happened on a military base and the military never knew it happened is absolutely atrocious. Or if they did, and again, that's a big if. And that the government won't admit that this is happening to the citizens of this world is unconscionable. And again, that falls back to Bud Hopkins' test through the Roper's poll back in 91. Hopkins claimed it was millions that had been done like this. That the government then, by default, is most likely working with such beings, trading these human tests, tortures, possibly murders, for the sake of technology and futuristic weapons, knowledge from such evil beings is in itself then evil as well.
With that, we can offer no more than this being one of the most sincere stories of an abduction memory that we've ever heard. I mean, we can't vet this any further than saying this victim is reputable. He is sincere, and we believe he told the absolute truth as he remembers it.
And again, just one more thing. As for primitive, and again, I've mentioned that a couple of times because he was really kind of stuck on that too. He is retired from the military. He holds advanced degrees in physics. He's one of the smartest men I think I've ever met, especially when it comes to math and the sciences. That they would call him barbaric, primitive, barely sentient. I don't know if that's insulting or worrisome.
Right.
Does this say a lot for their level of intelligence or just their vain ego and their vanity, their pride? Maybe both. Maybe they think they're that all powerful compared to us. I don't fully know.
And before I give our closing, if you do happen to hear some weird little bumps and taps along the way,
we've had sleet and hail and rain.
Middle of the most, pardon the phrase, god awful thunderstorm/tornado warning/hailstorm I think I have ever encountered.
We have done everything we can to keep this audio on track and sounding good for our podcast tonight. That, and I didn't want to actually have to retell this one again of all the ones I might have to.
So we have taken a few pauses here and there, and I apologize if there's anything.
Yeah, I've had to actually stop the recording 3 times, so you may actually have heard clicks during it too, where I had to stop and then rewind and do a little bit of cleanup, and I apologize for that. But we've had already during this show and the recording in the past 2 hours it's taken us to do this. We've had inch diameter hail. We've had thunder strikes. We've had a couple
lightning,
high winds, police car sirens out on the road, a couple of fools out there that acting crazy in their cars.
Hot rodding.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we've had a whole range of sound effects that we've tried to prevent from getting into the audio. But if you heard it,
we do apologize.
Please be tolerant. And again, this was an exceptional story that I did not want to diminish by just saying forget it, or especially I did not want to retell it. We
did want to wait till he left New Mexico. That way it couldn't be tied to
that way. If
he
didn't
want
to ever play it, that's up to him. If he never wanted to play it, he had, of course, he has our business card, but it doesn't mean he has to click on the link. So,
and that way it wouldn't connect with the time he was here. So if others did hear it, they'll go, "Hey, you were there then."
Yeah. So, because I didn't want this to cause him problems, but it definitely, I thought that it needed to go out to those that are interested in this genre of story. So it is as legitimate as I can vouch for him to say that if any story I've ever heard from anybody has ever been real, that one was. I believe he believes it. I believe that it happened to him. I believe that he believes it happened to him. And I think he's carrying around a tattoo of a brand on his right hip that tells me it wasn't just a bad dream and he had trouble waking his wife the next morning. So,
and as a person who has spoken to him and who has also spoken and met many of those who come here every year, including Travis Walton and them, for our UFO festival, I have met them before and spoken with them a couple of times. I believe him just as well as I believe Travis Walton. I have no doubts. So with that, we'll leave you, the listener, to decide. For the Rat Files, this is the Mouse.
And Lance.
And we're out of here.